session number 3790, reel 3.
Peter Johnson, reel 3.
Well,
just at the customs shed.
Yes, well, the customs officer couldn't understand that the suitcases had not been put in the locked compartment, and he saw, of course, that quite a few had been broken open. And I should think that this report from the customs, as well as the report from the sanitary inspector, must have gone back to England in the official diplomatic mail, so that the Home Office knew what happened, partly that way. Anyway, coming back to the security personnel, it was
well, something like that must have happened, because otherwise Scott wouldn't have been court-martialed.
Well, that happened afterwards. I'll go into that a bit later. Security personnel, whom I referred to, one was a lance corporal, one was a corporal or a sergeant, did complain, as they told us, because we got very friendly with these security people, who were intelligent fellows, that they complained to the officer in charge that he was not permitted to treat civilian prisoners, civilian internees, as we did. But he said they were only bloody lance jacks or corporals or sergeants. They had no jurisdiction. They had to do their job, and they were not to interfere. And so, naturally, their reports also went back to England, went back to the War Office and Home Office to report about the behavior of the personnel who were guarding us, or supposed to be guarding us.
Tell me about your reception in Australia. The Australians were expecting Nazi criminals, weren't they?
Well, we are not yet in Melbourne. We came to Melbourne, I'm sorry, Mrs. Brooks. In Melbourne, the Nazis were taken off ship, offloaded, and the Italians were offloaded, and they were taken to camps in Victoria, probably to Tatura. And we were taken to Sydney, past the harbour bridge, under the harbour bridge. And before we went off ship, Lieutenant Colonel, so-called Scott, announced to us that we would look back with pleasure to the marvelous treatment he had given us on the ship, because the Australians were very tough soldiers and they would know the works, how the works to give us, but he would go along to the camp and tell the camp commandant how to treat us. Anyway, now we were offloaded in Australia, and we could pick up our suitcases or bundles of clothing, whatever we had, and we marched to the train where the Home Guard of Australia, the diggers who'd been in the First World War, took us over, and when we got on the train, we were each issued with a luncheon box, which was an eye-opener to us to show how rich Australia was as far as food supplies. Anyway.
Why? What was it?
Well, we got white rolls, white bread. I mean, our bread in England was grey by that time. We got, I think, ham, and we got eggs, and I don't know what else we got. Anyway, it was a very nice luncheon box.
It wasn't very tactful of them to provide ham for a shipload of...
Well, they didn't know. I mean, those people who didn't eat ham gave the ham to somebody else, and they swapped. I mean, there's no difficulty. And we got chocolate, I suppose. Anyway, in every compartment we had one of those diggers, and they were delighted that we could talk English. They thought they were Germans, and Germans don't speak English. And we got on with these old sweats like a house on fire. And they were rolling their own fags, that paper and their tobacco. So they said, "If you want to have a smoke, have a smoke," so that we have no fags. So they gave us tobacco, and they showed us how to roll the cigarettes, and our people smoked with them. And we traveled through New South Wales, So they entered the line. And along the line, we watched out of the window and saw the kangaroos racing the train. And with the little ones looking out of the pouches, it was a delightful sight. The train was going pretty fast, and some of the kangaroos were left behind, and some kept pace, and it was very nice to look at the countryside, which was prairie. I can't remember how long we traveled. We must have traveled overnight, because 480 miles to Hay, New South Wales, is quite a stretch. And there we were unloaded and taken first to Camp 8, because our Camp 7 wasn't completed yet. We were going to be split up between Camp 7 and 8, which were a couple of hundred yards apart. And whilst we were in Camp 8, the next day, that evening, we were introduced to our camp commandant, Major Best. And the next day, Major Best came to the gate with Lieutenant Colonel Scott, who was going to show Major Best how to treat us. Well, they didn't even come to open the gate, because we started throwing stones, which was the right introduction to Major Best, what we thought of Lieutenant Colonel Scott. And so Major Best had chat with our spokesman afterwards, and he was told the story, what had happened on the ship, so he was informed. And after a few days, we were split up between Camp 7 and 8, and the Mr. Walter Vlies, whom I mentioned, who'd been running the Vega restaurant in London, we had gathered for him people who were vegetarians. He opened a vegetarian kitchen in Camp 8, whilst in Camp 7 we had the Orthodox kitchen. And that means that in the Camp 8, meat ration, which should have been allocated to the vegetarians, was given to the non-vegetarians. And in Camp 7, the meat ration, which would have gone to the Orthodox, went to the others. And consequently, instead of having 1 pound of meat a day as a ration, which was the Australian Army ration, we got 1.5 pounds of meat, those who ate meat. Well, I didn't eat meat also the internment. I just couldn't face it. And I could manage quite well. Anyway, the camps were kept apart, and unless people met on working parties outside, we could not communicate except via England or letters smuggled to the working parties outside. Anyway, to start with, we had 967 people in Camp 7 and 967 people in Camp 8. Both camps immediately started electing spokesmen. There were 32 huts. Or 28 huts? Let me see how it's 18. Yes, there were 36. I'm not quite sure. I think there must have been 36 huts, 18 each side, and each hut of 28 or 32 people, I can't remember, elected their spokesman, and these hut leaders elected a camp spokesman, and they met once a week in the mess hut, in one of the four mess huts, for a spokesman meeting. And this happened simultaneously in both camps. Both camps started immediately a camp school, a camp theater, and a camp orchestra. As some of the inmates in both camps had been in the First World War, some of them had been prisoners of war, and they knew that for the morale of the camp inmates, it was necessary to have as many activities going on as possible. We were told from the start by the military that we had to staff our own kitchen, and we had in both camps enough kitchen personnel to do the necessary, to have a storeman, an assistant to run the store, to have butchers to cut up the meat, to have cooks and preparing people and do the to have pastry cooks, soup cooks, and to run the proper organization. We had volunteers to look after the laundry. We had volunteers who did rather supervise our laundering, our own things. We had people to run the latrines. We had people to look after the wash houses and the showers. And it was run like a little civil service or government service, a local government in the small. And we had a medical hut to start with, and later on we had a hospital.
Was there something for everyone to do?
Unfortunately, there was not something to do for everybody, but there was not as far as actual work goes, but there was something to do to go to the classes in the camp school. We had bridge classes, and we had bridge people who played bridge. We had painters who gave painting lessons, and we had sculptors who gave sculpting classes, and they painted and sculpted themselves. They used the eucalyptus wood from the cookhouse for sculpting, and they sold some of their sculptures outside, for which they got Australian money, which was very useful. In some instances, they painted some of the guards, or they were asked out to the officers' mess to do some cleaning jobs, and some of them did drawings of officers and their families and sculptures, and they did all sorts of works, jobs. A man in my hut, Arthur Kurtz, who had been a PT instructor for the Bavarian police and had been on the blacklist of the Nazis, he was a sculptor and a painter and a gymnast, and he built himself a bratsche, which is a violoncello, near enough a violoncello, with which he made music in our orchestra. And he also was in the choir. And we had quite a full life. We had a camp library, in which one of the books was Lafitte's Internment of Aliens, which when the camp was dissolved, I grabbed. And unfortunately, I didn't get it back from somebody I lent it to. It was a 5,000 print issue and gave a very good description of the internment of the aliens in the Isle of Man and Canada and Australia.
Yes, we have a copy of it in the museum library.
I see, you're lucky. You're very lucky. I wished I could get my copy back. And
what did you do? Did you have a job?
Well, I was mess hut cleaner to start with. I was in charge of mess hut cleaners. I had to clean two mess huts. We had a team of six, I think. And after every meal, we cleaned the mess huts. And as soon as the first aid post was established, I volunteered to become orderly. And so I was the orderly in the medical hut. But we also had, in the administration, we had the post office, we had a police, we had the bank, and we had a canteen. Bank and canteen were tied up, and they had a register of all the inmates. The postman had a register of all the inmates, and the third register was in the medical hut, which I had to keep, and so I knew who was in which of the huts. And if there was a football game, we always had a few casualties we had to look after. And when people were inoculated for TAB or for tetanus because of the football, I was in attendance, and our doctors were issued by the medical personnel with some modern things, but they also very sensibly asked for some of the simpler medicaments which had been used also the ages which the British had forgotten about, some herbal things and some homeopathic things and some very simple treatments which we used for tinea, which is Eslitz foot, and we got people who got barber's rash, and because we got issued with blankets and our huts were not proof against the desert winds and desert sands. We had the upper, about a foot under the roof, we had chicken wire, and in order to get airing into the huts. But when we had a storm blowing up, the wind blew the sand into the huts and onto our blankets. And also when we aired our blankets outside on the wires, they collected dust. And so when people had to shave, they very often shaved very close, and the dust from the desert came onto the skin, and people developed barber's rash. And we had to treat this, and we usually treated it with triple dye or mercurochrome, and bandaged up people to heal the faces before they were let loose again. Meanwhile, of course, the beards grew again, and they had to be treated very, very carefully.
How did people come to have jobs? You said there weren't enough for everyone. I assume probably most people would have wanted to do one just to have some sort of activity.
Well, the thing was this, you see, in every to start with, you have to run the camp. The internees have to run the camp, be it prisoners of war or civil personnel. And jobs in the camp, every job in the camp was paid for. That means you got a pocket money. Now we asked, so our spokesman, if we could design our own camp money, because we had a very fine designer, and we were told yes. And he designed camp money in units up to a pound, I think. I don't know if I still have a set. I used to have a set, and it was a short barbed wire, and in the barbed wire it said the name of the camp, and on the back of the money we had sheep, and also in the sheep was disguised the name of the camp, as far as I remember, which was hay. And now I do not recollect, this is something which escapes me, if the if the jobs paid for in the camp were paid for by the Home Office, by the Australian military, or if it was paid by the profits the canteen made on the supplies which came in through the NAFI or from the stores. I have a suspicion it was paid for from the margins of the wholesale, between the wholesale and the retail profit the canteen made, so that we were quite self-supporting. People had money transferred from Britain, either from post office accounts or bank accounts, into the bank, so we held a bank account. And we could get our rations from the canteen. We could order anything from the stores in Sydney. We got catalogs from, I think David Jones was the biggest store in Sydney. And we could buy things for them, which was very useful. We could buy clothing, we could buy foodstuffs, we bought coffee from there. We had anything we wanted we could get if we had the money. And as we got paid for our jobs, we could buy cigarettes or chocolate, chewing gum. And so we were quite well off, really. And I think in some instances people made arrangements for gift parcels to be sent from Australia, from our money, to England, to our families.
Did any of the camp inmates, as it were, hire other refugees to be their servants or
valets? Well, I should think that some people did ask people to do certain jobs. We had a boy in the hut next to me. I was hut 27 and hut 24, who had learned from his father watchmaking, watch repairing. And he was a watch repairer. Of course, he got paid for it. And I should think that some people who did not want to do their own laundering employed somebody else to do their laundering and got paid for that, either in kind or in money, in camp money, of course. Certain repair jobs were being done. That's quite, I don't recollect, but I should think that was the case. The same thing was for shoe repairs. A friend of mine, Hans Adler, now John Henry Allen, is now manager, I think, of a shoe shop. He used to make shoe repairs. But we also used pieces from old tires for sandals. But we were also issued with sandals. And when we were in Australia, we were issued with Australian army boots, which were marvelous. They were much better than the British army boot. They had much softer uppers. And we were wearing Australian blue denims, and we were always encouraged to wear the hat, to protect the head and the neck against the sun, because it's very essential to have a sun protection in Australia. It's an absolutely crazy idea in Britain to expose yourself to the sun and then get a sunstroke. We had one of our inmates started a little zoo. He collected in the camp and outside the camp on working parties lizards, Australian lizards. Some of them look like dinosaurs, baby dinosaurs. They're delightful animals. They go for flies. They go for scorpions. We picked some scorpions, fed them the scorpions. We started a little garden. And while it's not in our camp, in the other camp they had a cafe. They had lots of Austrians, and they started a cafe. And they baked their cakes, and they made their pancakes, and served coffee with cakes, and they didn't have cream, but they could serve their coffee, stuff which they could buy through the canteen.
How was your health during the time you were there?
Oh, my health was fine. Well, I was very lucky. I had, thanks to nervous condition, I had suffered of enuresis, bedwetting, as a child as well as in England, which was very embarrassing. And for that reason, I had avoided having a girlfriend because I was afraid that if I was with a girl, I would suddenly start to wet myself. Well, being in Australia was a godsend for me. I was away from the nervous stresses of my parents, who had been fighting all the time until they got divorced. And I got rid of my neurosis, and I'm ever grateful for that. So as far as I'm concerned, I was fine. I think I had a bit of barber's rash, but very little. But as I was working at Source, as I was working in the medical hut, and I had access to all the medical supplies, I never had any trouble with anything. But I enjoyed working in the medical hut because I was working with half a dozen doctors who gave me a lot of knowledge, and we made several gadgets ourselves. I've still got some of the gadgets. I've still got a gadget for rolling up bandages, and I think I've still got a gadget which we used for making powders, for mixing powders. What do you call this thing? We can use it for cake making as well. You've got a bowl, and you've got a thing with a knob for breaking up things.
Mortar and pestle.
Yes, mortar and pestle. I've still got, the thing you hold is a pestle, is it? Well, I think I've still got one of those pestles knocking around. And I think I've still got some bandages, because at one stage, the Red Cross from Chile sent us bandages and sent us shirts and underwear. It was very amusing, because Chile had a very large German population, and the Germans, the non-Jews, were very good Nazis, and they'd been supporting the war effort in Germany. But amongst the Jewish population in Chile, who'd gone there after the first or second war, we found amongst the labels in the shirts Jewish names, which were partly with Spanish names, and this was very interesting for us. But coming back to the beginning of the internment, the first week in Australia, rather, we were visited by Bishop Pilcher, who was the bishop, I think the Anglican bishop, in Sydney, and he went to see the Protestants in the camp, and they reported to him what had happened on the ship. They gave him the true background, and he passed this matter on through church channels to the Home Office. And so the House of Commons was informed of what happened on the ship before the Dunera got back to England. And so there was a reception committee for Lieutenant Colonel Scott and his cronies, and they were marched to a detention camp. Anyway, when the camps had been split, the Swiss consul made arrangements to come to the camps to visit prisoners of war, and we put up notices at our headquarters office. Anybody who wants to see the Swiss consul should put their name down. In our Camp 7, there was only one who was a Nazi who had accidentally got into our camp and who had applied to be transferred to a Nazi camp. Andrew Eppenstein, our spokesman, spoke to this man and said, "Look, you know our situation. We suggest the following, that you also refuse to see the Swiss consul, because we want to show a uniform front that we do not want to have any connection with the German government, who is represented by the Swiss, and we are prepared to give you from our canteen your soap, your razor, your shaving supply, your chocolate, your cigarettes,